You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. We continue on a Wednesday, hump day across the world. Maybe. I'm not sure. The world's got a different work schedule than we do. I mean, some people work 6 days a week. And in that case, I don't. Hump day might be at midnight. I'm not sure. Tim, do you know? I mean, a lot of people work 6 days a week. For some cultures, Friday is Sunday. Is this hump day around the world or just in the United States?
I think it's pretty much just the United States, Matt, because Thursday night's the big party night in the Muslim world.
What about Europe? They're a Monday through Friday type of organization, aren't they?
That's not best to my knowledge. I've not spent a ton of time there, but yeah, they seem to mimic us.
Why haven't you been to Europe? You're kind of a world traveler. I've only stopped there going to and coming from. I've not been there either. I've spent more time in the Orient than I certainly have in Europe. And mostly there, seeing not very nice places, but a few nice places. How come you've never been to Europe?
Well, Europe is really, really nice, and I seem to be a connoisseur of third world shitholes, you know. But I went the first time I spent any time in Europe was when I came into contract, and I flew into London to sign a contract. Was given a beer, toast, cheers, Tim. Yeah, go back, you go. And then next thing you know, I was at the airport heading to Baghdad. So I don't have a lot of loiter time in the continent, unfortunately.
Okay. All right. Is there a place that you'd like to go there?
Hey, I went to Amsterdam to speak at a conference once, and that place was crazy. You can't smoke cigarettes in a coffee house, but everybody's smoking dope in there. It was weird. It was just weird.
Wait. Say that again. You can't smoke a cigarette, tobacco cigarette, but you can smoke other things.
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. That's the only thing you could smoke. And it was just kind of, and I mean in every coffee house. But it was a beautiful town, and I was there for 4 or 5 days. I only had to talk for a half hour, so it was, I got a chance to look around. And it was nice, but I had friggin' malaria when I got in there. So my first 2 days I was getting off and on fever and sweats. It was miserable.
Where did you pick up the malaria?
Jalalabad. I don't know if you remember, but I'm a former lab tech as a corpsman, so I know my species, and it wasn't, it was Vivax, not the falciparum malaria. I had the sissy malaria, and it didn't really hurt me too bad.
Okay. All right. That's a pretty good gig, 4 days and speaking only a few hours. That's not a bad deal.
As an MIT gig, I was speaking on behalf of, I was speaking to the fab lab we had in Jalalabad, and all these other guys. They had a guy from Spain from the Basque region, and a guy from Northern Ireland, and they give their talks about how the fab lab is going. I get up and I put up a picture of a MRAP that got hit by an IED and 5 or 6 different stores that had gotten blown up within the last week, within a mile of the fab lab, and I said, and they're still coming, and they're still trying, and they're still reaching out. And I sat down, and it was a good speech. I normally run my soup cooler too much, so that was a pretty good one on my part.
The Tim Lynch now, we need to do a little quick introduction. Tim, the son of, you've heard him on the program before, Major General Jarvis Lynch, USMC retired. So you've heard General Lynch here before. You've also heard his uncle, Chuck Lynch, most famous not for his time in Vietnam, but for his throwaway comment, yeah, I think I did over 100 CAECO calls while I was on recruiting duty, which still is one of the moments of this program, and then just stopped it. Hold on. We're not ending on that. Are you kidding me? Which actually got me, and I still haven't solved this little bit of a riddle. When did we actually start doing notifications? And I look for a history of casualty assistance officers, and I have yet to find one that says, yeah, in 1961, the Department of Defense decided that we would do notifications in person. Blah, 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 blah. I've yet to run across that. As opposed to World War II style, was Telegram. And I don't know how we did it in Korea, but your uncle's comment kind of spurned a curiosity in me. So anyway, that, and the other thing I'm interested in is it doesn't seem like we did memorial services until recently, although I just heard a guy in an interview talked about, when we got back, there was, M14s with bayonets fixed in the ground, 14 of them, with helmets and packs at the base. Some units did hold them. So I'm kind of curious about those two things. One of them spurned by Tim's uncle. Now, Tim himself is a corpsman, former United States Navy corpsman, and then got out of the Navy and joined the Marine Corps, went through officer candidate school, became an infantry officer, and then got out in what year, Tim?
2000,
and then went back to Afghanistan. Did you do any time in Iraq?
I did about 4 months in Baghdad, and I was getting sent up to northern Iraq because they were having problems with this fuel escort. They had an excessive casualty problems.
Right.
And they wanted me to go up there and sort it all out, but I came back, and then they vectored me off to Kabul to take over the embassy from the Marines because I was the only American officer they had that still had a clearance. I'd like to think I still would have gone anyway, but I had a good time working for the Brits, and I was working mostly with South Africans. And the South Africans were so proficient at that kind of stuff, it was scary. They were fun to work with, a fun crew.
So then he makes his way to Afghanistan, initially doing security work, or how did you initially get to Afghanistan?
So I go there, I take over, I stand up the American the GAP force. We were a temporary force until they awarded the contract, and I stood this up for Global, a British company, and it was a very, very difficult evolution. But once it was up and running and going smoothly, I left because I hated it. It was not a lot of fun working with the State Department on that thing, and I felt that they were exposing us to unnecessary. I mean, our first camp was just off of Jalalabad Road. Right next to the wall of our barracks was a temporary parking place for trucks, for Christ's sakes. And I'm like, you guys have got to be kidding me. I would rail about this. And I just left out of frustration and started my own company with another guy. And we had a run for a couple of years, but it petered out once the Afghans started really putting the screws down on the international security market. We didn't have the money to do it.
Okay. So then you finish that, and then you go back there, or that evolves into what?
That evolves into working with a reconstruction piece with a Central Asia Development Group out of Singapore, owned by an American former SF guy and his wife, but out of Singapore. And we were on a hybrid program called Direct Implementation, which meant no security company, no compounds, no armored cars, local clothes, local vehicles, local compounds, and we supervised all work. And that included in the Connecticut, we only worked in Connecticut areas, and between myself and Tim Seeley in Kandahar and John Binsdown, who started out at Alaska Guard, I mean, we never failed to accomplish our project. Everything came in on time and on budget. And it was huge. I mean,
okay, all right. Hold on. Tim is a lot like the chef of All Marine Radio. If you don't keep him corralled, you'll start in Jalalabad. You'll wind up at Camp Muchuk, and you won't know how you got there. Okay, so it's a bit of a challenge. Okay, so now you're now signed up to go back to the Helmand Province of Afghanistan. Can you tell us any update on that? And when you're heading back, talk to us.
I started this. I'm self-funding to go back. There's nobody sending me. And I started a GoFundMe campaign, which is doing well. Spent a week with the Marines getting to know the guys I want to embed with. And right now I'm shooting for end of July.
Okay, so end of July. And then we'll start to get reports from the front as Tim goes back to Afghanistan. The 215th Corps, can you explain to everybody the basis of the Marine redeployment to Helmand? And my understanding, it's a historical relationship with the 215th Corps?
That's correct. They've got a historical relationship. There's a lot of Marines in that task force that have been that have worked with the 215th before. The 215th has been getting hammered. They're taking most of the casualties, my assumption is we're going back to stiffen them up because I don't believe we're bringing enablers with us. So I think we're just going down and going over again, just the basic planning and training for fire maneuver, as best as I can tell.
Okay, so no forward air controllers, no FOs down to the battalion level?
Nope, not that. As far as I can tell, no.
Okay.
And I really, you know, you and I, we both know General Tucker. I mean, we've known him for a long time, and I really didn't feel like sitting there and pressuring him on stuff that he didn't want to talk about.
Oh, I will. I will. He's, well, maybe he can say he doesn't want to answer, but he was a student of mine. He'll answer my question, damn it.
Yeah.
That's how that shit's going to work.
Yeah, but I was there as a reporter. I had to wear a press badge and everything like that. And
then be a reporter. Ask him. He can say, I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, I went bad. I'm not a good
That's all right. There's no shame in saying that, okay?
I
guess the question is, now, advising. When we say advising, what does the host nation want from us?
Well, normally they're going to want us to be out with their formations in combat as advisors, like Vietnam, all the Vietnam vets you're talking about, where advisor shows up and he's now their key to the enablers that America has over there.
Thank you.
Controlling the craft and controlling
okay.
Our support.
So when we say advisors, what do they want?
I think that's what they want.
They want the big supporting arms.
Right. That's what they want.
So we say advising, and what they hear is we need American air power. We need American artillery to rain down and make and change the table here. And so when you talk about advising, in fact, one of the things that happened during the pause in Mosul here most recently was, hey, we need some of your help a little bit further forward. And and there were some modifications made to the order of battle in and around Mosul. And specifically, where our advisors are controlling advising on where to drop 1,000-pound bombs and laser-guided munitions and all kinds of other things we do. So in terms of advising, that's again, America changes the battlefield. We can drop it through your windshield. We can put it in your ashtray, and the people that we go to fight with, they know that, and that's what they really need. They do not want to hook and jab this thing on an equal footing. I mean, hell, nobody does. And so the 215th Corps has seen us do it, as the Iraqis had, and they want that stuff. Hey, because that way we don't have to go up there, you know, mano-a-mano and make it work like that. So, mm-hmm. but again, it all depends on, you know, what's been asked and what we're supposed to do. Yada, 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 yada. Have you read the stories that the Governance Center was moved in Sangin, which reported some news outlets to report Sangin had fallen, and the response from the Department of Defense said, no, our understanding of it is they've simply moved the Governance Center. Have you heard
right.
any of that? And no. what do you make of it?
Well, yeah, I actually wrote a post on it last week. I think what they did is I know what they did. They got the ANA out of the bazaar in the center of Sangin, moved them off the base because whoever controls the bazaar in Sangin is basically controlling the northern Helmand opium trade. And there's plenty of guys, they're fighting themselves over that right now.
Okay,
they backed out.
Okay, so ANA, yeah. ANA is?
Oh, ANA is the Afghan National Army.
Okay, so what's critical about the northern part of Helmand in the Sangin area is what, Tim?
Well, it's critical. It's opium. It is Hellman accounts for most of the opium coming out of Afghanistan, and it's a multi-billion-dollar business.
Yeah, it's a big deal. And the problem is culturally, there is no crop on the horizon that will supplant opium in terms of what it's able to generate, and then what it generates has to pay bribes at every level, and we'll call them bribes, but it's the cost of doing business in most nations. So it has to grease the skids, whether you be transporting, whether you have to, the mayor, the police, everybody's got to get taken care of. And there's nothing close to it. Now, I've heard the discussion, John Allen told me about pomegranates, but that is a 5-year flash to bang. Planting the tree before it yields its first bona fide crop. Mm-hmm. And so there's an economic problem. And like all farmers, the farmers in Hellman can add and subtract. They understand money. And they understand that there isn't another crop that they can plant that will give off the money that opium does. And it's mm-hmm. not a very wealthy place. So back into that, and so you can see the strategic value to the Taliban, because this is their treasury, and Northern Hellman and the opium trade is a big deal. So anyway, so Tim is headed back there. Tell me something that we don't know about that whole movement relative to the governance center in Northern Hellman.
Yeah, they were up there. They had local support from the Alakazai tribe, which came in 2011, joined the government side after the Marines had counted them pretty good, and they were up there. So they had local support. Okay. They've pulled out now. The Alakazai and his other two tribes, now they're warring with each other, and the ANA's just stepped out of it. You know, they basically they left the other tribe kind of hanging, but that's the way it goes there. You know. And so it's up to the Alakazai now to make amends with their neighbors and try to calm down the level of violence as much as they possibly can, which they could calm it down a lot, but the level of violence would be what we would consider a little bit unacceptable. It's the Hatfields and McCoys on steroids.
Okay, so can you simplify the conflict for us? Is it a fight about who controls opium? Is it so the locals are caught in this struggle between the Taliban and the national government, Jiroa as mm-hmm. it's known, what is the fight over? Is it over simply the opium trade? Is it for hearts and minds in a greater struggle? What is the struggle in Hellman about?
The struggle in Hellman, it appears to me, from my time on the ground and from my reading and whatnot, is more of an inner tribal struggle for dominance. And it seems to be a little bit isolated from the other problems that Afghanistan has. And what they're fighting for, what the Afghans want, is to get the title to their land cleared up, clear and free, and to basically be left alone. They'll tolerate a little bit of having to pay to get past tolls and whatnot, because they always had to do that, and they always will. And that's not bothering too much. It's the uncertainty about who owns what land that's driving this, because the Taliban put a lot of people down south of Goresh, down in your old area, a lot of people. And of course, as soon as the Taliban were thrown out, those deeds were thrown out,
right.
And those people were vulnerable. Now nobody seems to know who owns what, and that's the issue.
Right. And you can, obviously, with the lack of stability, the Americans come, the Afghan national government comes, the Americans go, the Afghan national government is on the wane, the Taliban, you know, comes back. Breaking news right now, USF-16 crashes several miles outside of Joint Base Andrews in Maryland. The pilot ejected. No word on his or her condition yet. So we'll keep you updated on that. A couple emails, Tim. Hey, Mac, the news out of Syria yesterday, the deployment of chemical weapons against civilians. I heard you talk a little bit about it. Do you have any experience with it? Does Tim have any experience with it? what a ballless, gutless, cowardly move. I saw the video of those civilians washing down children, trying to get the agent off them. It made me cry. And I don't cry easily, but oh my God, can you imagine your baby, one of your kids, dying of some kind of agent that got dropped on you? It's unbelievable to me. Those guys need to go. Those guys need to go away. It's just awful. So, Tim, do you have any experience with chemicals at all?
I actually do. Before I went overseas, I was working at Dugwood Proving Grounds, training the civil support teams, weapons of mass destruction civil support teams. And so I've got a lot of time in the lab with chemicals. And what I'll tell you about chemicals are they're a terror weapon. The reaction of your emailer is exactly the intent of the chemicals, because if you had liberty to do so, HE will generate bigger casualties than chemicals will. Those chemicals dissipate. You know, the wind gets them, the temperature. It's a very, very precise science to lay chemicals that's going to stay. And the Iraqis didn't do that, or they would have had much more casualties. Right. They just dosed them, and the wind and the sun did its thing, and it dissipated after a while. But yeah, if you're the one that's getting slimed, it's a horrible, horrible way to go. And that's the point. That's why they gas people, is to degrade your effectiveness by making you mop up. And then sliming you and leaving you in the mop suits, and you can tell me about trying to fight in mop suits, because I never did that.
No, I didn't either. I got there after the markup. But the only experience I have with it is our EOD guys in Iraq, mostly Army guys, that found caches of ordnance, did not know initially that they were mustard gas, and handled them. And then had issues going as they sought to return to base. They had guys passing out. They had guys, you know, coughing, and they finally got them to medical. And they said, "Yeah, you guys have been exposed to a chemical agent." And so that's my only experience. And even that, for those guys, just that small exposure will affect them for the rest of their lives. They're horrible weapons. Tim's point is one that most people don't realize about chemical weapons. It's really difficult to give the kind of dose that you need in a military sense to have an impact. The weather's got to be right, the winds have to be right, all of that has to work in order for you to get enough of the agent to stick around to be effective. The problem is you just drew a big black X over that terrain, because you can't go there either, unless you want to do the whole mop up, go through it, and then you got to, on the back side of it, now you're exposed to it. You've got to decontaminate your vehicles, you got to decontaminate your equipment, you got to decontaminate your people. It's a nightmare to try to operate in that environment. And so you know back in the 80s, you know, we were convinced that the Soviets were going to, you know, do that. You know, now in retrospect, you know, everything I see of them tends to be nonsense. They might say they have a capability, but they don't do it very well. They do it horribly. You know, that's why, you know, you have never seen an F-16 get knocked out of the sky, whether it be flown by the Israelis or the Americans, by any kind of MiG aircraft. Doesn't happen. Why is that? Is it a hardware issue? Is it a pilot issue? I don't know. Probably a little bit of both. But everything they sell, you know, in terms of the way they do it, doesn't really work that well, you know. And so I their ability to do chemical weapons, I would tell you that more of their guys would die than our guys. Not that that would bother them, but, I think that was tremendously oversold, because that stuff is messy. And it's not easy, but my experience with it is limited to, you know, some finding of that stuff in Iraq, because they moved that ordnance around, and at the tactical level there wasn't a whole lot of it, and a lot of it was left over from the Iran-Iraq war when they used to do that to each other on a regular basis, and so interesting. Somebody sent me this story. I didn't see it in the early bird. The date on this is April 4th, and that is Navy instructor pilots refusing to fly over safety concerns. Pence's son affected. Now that's the, yeah,
that's ridiculous.
Yeah,
I saw that. It's just funny how it just gets politicized, right?
Yeah, right. So Pence's like kid is like in a pool of naval aviators, right? And he's affected like everybody else down there. But the headline of the story to sell the click is what? Pence's son. Anyway, they're having an oxygen problem. And the pilots are saying, yeah, we're not going to fly on that. So it's the T-45, which has been around forever. And now the oxygen system in it is evidently causing issues. So pilots are refusing to fly. We're not going to fly on this. And I'll tell you what, that's something you might see more of coming up, because the Marine Corps, in a similar vein, is going to museums to scavenge parts for F-18s. And so at some point, when does it become unsafe enough for you to say, you know what, I'm not going up in that. That thing's not safe. So they're on strike down in Pensacola, which I've never been, but I've heard Pensacola's a nice place. Tim's been.
Yeah, oh yeah, I've been to Pensacola a couple of times. It's a very nice place.
Would you go on strike in Pensacola?
Well, if I was going to go on strike, Pensacola would be where I'd do it. I have a hard time imagining myself saying I'm not going to fly an airplane if I'm a pilot. But I mean, I don't know about being a pilot. If those guys are that adamant about it, I imagine they've got a point.
The story says more than 100 U.S. Navy instructor pilots are refusing to fly in protest of what they say is the refusal of top brass to adequately address an urgent problem with training jets' oxygen system. Multiple instructor pilots tell Fox News. The boycott started late last week and has effectively grounded hundreds of training flights. The pilots don't feel safe flying this aircraft, one instructor told Fox News. And then it talks about Pence's kid is down there training. Right now, we don't have a smoking gun, Vice Admiral Mike Shoemaker said. He said the training jet issue is the number one safety priority across naval aviation right now, which is saying something because the F-18 is in that mix as well. The Navy is looking at grounding the entire fleet in the next few days. There's no question that there are problems that are being covered up. House Armed Service Committee Chairman Mac Thornberry, Republican from Texas, said, I'm very concerned about the issue. It's been getting worse over time, and if you look at the statistics, the older planes are having bigger problems than the newer planes. So anyway, John McCain, naval aviator himself, said, quote, the Navy must address these safety concerns swiftly and decisively. So that's the latest on that story. What else is on your mind as an American?
Well, I'll tell you what's on my mind. I started reading a book here yesterday called The War with Russia, written by the guy that just stepped down as a deputy Sakyor, a British four-star, right?
Okay.
And I'm at the very beginning. The date on the chapter is May 2017, and it's the Russians talking about what you're talking about, which is, I don't think these guys can sortie fight right now. If we're going to make a go of it, let's go now. And they're coming across, and they're grabbing the Balkans. And because they basically say the United States can't do it. They don't even have plans. I mean, the guy's talking about these problems in the book. It's amazing.
Yeah, if you were smart, you'd go now.
Yeah, that's exactly what the guy's saying. And he's laying out and he's naming names about people that just have not been paying attention to what the heck's going on.
He's naming names?
Oh, yeah.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Barack, I mean, there's the people that are contemporary in the bills he's writing about are in the book.
Yikes.
And the thing that was interesting is I've always felt that we had more in common with Russia vis-a-vis the Islamic terrorism threat than and we should be friends and cooperating. And this guy said he's had the senior generals in his own home entertaining these guys, basically did everything they could to put the olive branch out and say, we want to work together, and the Russians were having none of it. And there you go. Which to me is a stupid thing to do. But you know, I mean, if you track down like the beginning of World War I and stuff, it's all a bunch of stupid decisions that in retrospect should have never been made. But that's sort of like the way it goes, isn't it?
You know, it seems that way. It seems that way. And I have friends, you know, Mike Musselman.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, you know, Rob Schwartz too.
Sure. Yeah,
right?
I know.
Right? The RCT1 guys. And Tim was over there when we were there. And they've taken to not watching the news. Can't take it anymore.
No, I did the same myself for a while. It's depressing.
Yeah, it's absolutely depressing that as a nation, you know, now, I mean, we can't do the most. We don't pass budgets anymore. We can't confirm a Supreme Court justice, and we're gonna we're gonna rewrite the rules of the Senate because we can't. And I had a senator on here that, you know, not on this program, but another one I do, talking about you can't compromise anymore. If you compromise, the only thing that you will assure yourself is a contested primary in your own party. You'll be called a sellout. And mm-hmm. And what's interesting, Tim, and is as he, you know, kind of documents the argument, he says, look, I would take it back to the fairness doctrine. And when the media polarized, there eliminated any balanced discussion. And so slowly but surely, the middle ground has gone away because there is no balance in terms of content. So if you go there, you're going to get annihilated by one side or the other, or probably both if you're in the middle ground. So it's safer to stay on either extreme. You'll be covered by at least a part of the media. And I thought that was interesting, which leads me to this question that I'll put to you. Is the truth too important to entrust to the American media that is click-driven, profit-driven media? And so in my mind's eye, I have the McNeil Lear NewsHour, right? Jim Lear, former Marine, right? But it was balanced content. It was articulate discussion. It was footnoted. It was measured. It wasn't shrill and hysterical. In my mind's eye, that's what I have. That doesn't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm. So, and that was a good news program. I agree.
Right. I mean,
Neil Lear.
Because look, I think those of us, even though you and I'll tell you, even if you have a conservative, if you have a liberal lean, you can still appreciate conservative discussion, conservative points, you know, done in a forum like that. I mean, and you appreciate it because it makes you consider it. And the same thing with conservatives. You hear liberal points of view from articulate people in a measured, footnoted conversation, and it makes you think about, geez, is my position valid? You know, should I? We don't have that anymore. So your thoughts on that. Is it too important to entrust to a profit, click-driven media?
I think it is. I have not been a fan of the media since literally all my adult life. I've always thought that I've always sensed a bias, and it comes from my dad's experience in Vietnam and the way that was covered. But the only alternatives you have now, I will give you a name, Dan Carlin. He does two podcasts, Hardcore History and Common Sense. That's the guy. He's a liberal guy. That's the guy I'll listen to every time because what he talks about is reasoned. It makes sense. I mean, we're looking at this Judge Gorsuch. He's got to be the most qualified Supreme Court justice I've ever seen in my life. This guy's he's a national treasure. He's so damn smart, and he can't get confirmed. I mean, to me, the way things are going now is friggin' crazy. And we're still talking about Russia hacking the election, and I still say that that's nonsense. And what affected the election more? Podesta's emails or Hillary Clinton, the big questions before the debate. Nobody talks about that. But that was clearly trying to influence.
Yeah, but I would just say this. Again, given the visibility of the issue, someone needs to look at it and get to the truth about it.
That would be nice.
Yeah, get to the truth. And to me, that five-letter word, the truth, is something that we don't deal with a whole lot anymore. Just, you know, you assert it, you scream it loud enough, and then we're on to the next event.
Mm-hmm.
What? What just happened? Did we just accept that as truth? So, interesting. All right. We will talk to you again. I always appreciate the discussion. And give me, what's your plan today? What's on the training schedule?
Man, not a darn thing, but I'm going to go by the Navy Hospital and pick up some medications, and then at 17:30, it's an hour in the boxing ring.
Nice, we like that. Sounds like
a title boxing club. I don't fight somebody. It's heavy bag work. It's, you know, but you got a guy pushing. There'd be about 30-40 people there, and it's a boy, burn your butt, man. I am done by the time I'm through that.
Awesome.
But yeah, my girlfriend and I, we go. She can hit a heavy bag too.
I love that. We love girls who hit the heavy bag. All right.
Yeah.
Tim Lynch, tell everybody where they can find your work.
www.freerangeinternational.com.
All right. Thanks, bud.
Yeah, right, buddy. You have a great day. Thanks, man.
Yeah, there you have it. Tim Lynch, man of the world. Interesting guy. The truth. How about that for a novel concept? What a joke. All right, we're going to take a break when we come back. John Ubaldi of the Ubaldi Reports joins us for the first time. You get a chance to meet him. And we'll get his thoughts on all this stuff, because he's got an opinion. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner. Proven and dependable.